2012 demonstration against nuclear weapons of mass destruction at the U.S. government's top-secret Y-12 nuclear weapons facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. So when you hear Sister Megan explain that her reasons for demonstrating were
renouncing and denouncing and exposing nuclear weapons or any crime, we're all invited, humanly speaking, we must expose and oppose crimes against humanity. There's only one thing to do, and that is anybody who is available and free to expose and oppose nuclear weapons of mass destruction.
She makes it sound so simple and logical that when you hear a call to action like that from a woman like that, it's possible to think that maybe we can join together to eliminate this seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, for the holiday season, we revisit an inspirational interview with Sister Megan Rice, the 85-year-old nun and anti-nuclear peace activist who, with two comparably senior accomplices, broke into the Y-12 site in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, often referred to as this country's Fort Knox for uranium. After their brief, peaceful protest, they were tried by our government on sabotage charges and found guilty. After more than 2 years in prison, the sabotage charge was overturned, and I spoke with Sister Megan and one of her two co-activists, 60-year-old Gregory Borcha Obed, less than 2 weeks after their release. We will also have Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness and more honest nuclear information than Santa's probably going to be leaving under anyone's tree. Today is Tuesday, December 24, 2019, and here is this week's nuclear information from a different perspective. Starting out with everyone's favorite...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, Numbnuts of the Week!
The nuclear industry just loves its buzzwords and buzz concepts, especially when picked up on and pushed out into the media by the gullible, the ignorant, the fully programmed, and or its bought and sold minions. Now, I'm not saying which one of those he belongs in, but you can place pro-nuke Andrew Yang, Democratic candidate for president who has not a single chance of winning any nomination, but has in the process of running become a very high-profile mouthpiece for the industry's latest recycle buzzword, thorium. Millionaire businessman Yang is well known as a nuke booster who falsely believes that thorium-based nuclear reactors are the way to go to address climate change, saying that it is, quote, superior to uranium on many levels. Note to the Yang campaign, if you want information as to why nukes are not green, I will be happy to send you a list of links to Nuclear Hot Seat interviews that address this very issue. As for this latest bit about thorium, Andy, if you want to live up to your campaign slogan, Humanity First, great focus group consensus on that one, consider the truth about thorium as it comes from genuine nuclear experts and not just whatever nuke booster you're getting your talking points from. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, yeah, the place where nuclear experts write articles to communicate with each other about scientific truths, has two articles in particular that you should really read yourself and not get interpreted by your underlings. Most recently is from December 18, 2019, entitled Fact Check, Five Claims About Thorium, made by Andrew Yang, written by John Krasiansky and Nicholas Brown. It states, the public has good reason to be skeptical that thorium can or should play any role in the future. Just a few. Yang claims that thorium reactors would be more economical than traditional uranium reactors because thorium is more abundant than uranium. That's false, because although thorium is more abundant than uranium, the cost of uranium is a small fraction of the overall cost of nuclear energy. Yang claims that the waste from thorium reactors would be easier to deal with than waste from today's uranium reactors. That's false. A comprehensive study from the U.S. Energy Department in 2014 found that waste from thorium-uranium fuel cycles has similar radioactivity at 100 years to uranium-plutonium fuel cycles, that's the two different models, and actually has a higher waste radioactivity at 100,000 years. Humanity should live that long. Yang also claims that thorium would be more proliferation-resistant than current reactors, meaning you can't make nuclear weapons out of it. And that is false. A 2020 study funded by the National Nuclear Security Administration found that the byproducts of a thorium fuel cycle, in particular uranium-233, can potentially be attractive material for making nuclear weapons. And a 2012 study published in Nature from the University of Cambridge also concluded that thorium fuel cycles pose significant proliferation risks. There's also a 2014 article from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists by Robert Alvarez. Bob is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies who served as senior policy advisor to the Energy Department's secretary and deputy assistant secretary for national security and the environment from 1993 to 1999. And during this time, Bob led teams in North Korea to establish control of nuclear weapons material. The article is entitled Thorium, the Wonder Fuel That Wasn't, and says in part, the United States has tried to develop thorium as an energy source for some 50 years and is still struggling to deal with the legacy of those attempts. In addition to the billions of dollars it spent, mostly fruitlessly, to develop thorium fuels, the U.S. government will have to spend billions more at numerous federal nuclear sites to deal with the waste produced by these efforts. And that's why, Andrew Yang, for your willful thorium ignorance, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We will link to both those articles on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 444. Here's this week's featured interview, a special encore presentation for the holidays.
I don't know if it's possible to feel both proud and humbled, but I feel both at the thought of being able to bring to you the next three interviews with today's guests, the activists of Transform Now Plowshares. First, Sister Megan Rice. She is an 85-year-old anti-nuclear activist and Roman Catholic nun of the Society of the Holy Child Jesus. On July 28, 2012, at the age of 82, she, then 57-year-old Greg Borcha Obed and 63-year-old Michael Wally, broke into the Y-12 National Security Complex in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the U.S. government's weapons facility. In a peaceful protest they called Transform Now Plowshares, the trio squeezed baby bottles of donated human blood on the outer walls of the supposedly heavily guarded, highly enriched uranium materials facility. They then spray-painted anti-war slogans, hit the walls with small hammers, put up crime scene tape, prayed, and sang. She and her co-activists were arrested, tried, and convicted, not of misdemeanor trespass, the initial charge against them, but of attempting to sabotage the security of the United States. As you will hear, they should have been paid a fat consulting fee for safely exposing such a hole in U.S. nuclear weapons security. But that was not the case. For this peaceful protest action, Sister Megan received a sentence of almost 3 years in prison, and her co-activists received sentences of over 5 years each. After serving more than 2 years just 2 weeks ago, on May 12th, The conviction on sabotage against all three was overturned by the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. 5 days later, she and the others were released. Part of the court ruling read, "Vague platitudes about a facility's crucial role in the national defense are not enough to convict a defendant of sabotage." Amen to that. I spoke with Sister Megan on Monday, May 25th, 2015.
Sister Megan, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much.
First of all, did you know that your case was in the process of being reviewed by the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals? And were you in any way expecting that the sabotage ruling against you was going to be taken away?
I certainly knew it was happening, and I can only say common sense would say that's what would have to happen. So, anything, we're always ready for every surprise in this country.
And common sense is not necessarily the most common thing we have, so it was great news that was received by people throughout internationally, our community. When you learned of the court's decision, what was your reaction?
I wasn't all that excited because I really expected that that would happen. I found out at 3 in the morning, I was listening to the BBC, and it was just a tiny little announcement of, at the end of a 6 or 7 minute summary of the world news. And it just said in a statement that, you know, the naming us all are given immediate release.
Let's take this back to how the action started. This has been credited, or at least been mentioned in connection with something called Transform Now Plowshares. Is that a group? Is that a movement? Tell us a bit about what that is.
Since about 1980, starting with Father Dan Berrigan, Brother Bill Berrigan, started the Plowshares movement, which has done many, many actions, direct actions to expose the illegality and the immorality that we all know in our hearts of nuclear weapons. And so each of the actions, I'm not sure of the number in my head, but it's certainly more than 30, but I don't know, has a special name, just like every battleship has a special name. And so the last one, which happened on the 2nd of November, 2009, in Kitsap, Bangor, Trident Submarine Base, was called Disarm Now. And it came to me that, okay, what's the next step? You know, part of the process, the main process of disarming is not to deplete the planet and stop, end all the jobs for people, but to transform the whole thing into what we need. So the word transformation just came. So the next step after disarming, on really part of it, is transform now into life-enhancing alternatives.
How was the determination made that you would target the Y-12 uranium depository at Oak Ridge?
That was the research that we were doing, mainly at that point, Greg and I. We were moving from community to community. He lived in Duluth, and so we went east. We had to go east anyway, and we stopped in Kansas City, which was the place where they were making all the non-nuclear parts to nuclear weapons, for, in other words, continuing the proliferation of nuclear weapons. They were willing to do something for August 2012, so we didn't need to do anything there. Then we moved on eastward and consulted with the peace movements all along the way in communities that were there. We got up to Maine, even to Bangor, near Portland, you know, Bath. And that was another submarine carrier manufacturing place. And then we moved down and we realized that the one that hadn't had a good direct action was Oak Ridge. We wanted to have something for 2012, August 6th and August 9th, you know, something around that time to remember. 68 years ago.
You, Michael, and Greg took several symbolic actions on the site. How did you determine what those actions were and what they would symbolize?
It was very easy. I mean, these are the same symbols that have been used, and we've meditated on them and understood them. I started being connected with Jonah House after my mother died, and I was there in 1999 and 2000 when an action was going on. So I was there to reflect and pray with that community and be instructed by Phil Berrigan and Liz and the people living there. And I understood fully, and the same way with Greg, he was living there. We understood the importance of those symbols of exterminating sacred life. So the sacred symbol of life certainly is blood. And to show that to the workers without having to say anything was very educative. And renouncing and denouncing and exposing nuclear weapons or any crime, we're all invited, humanly speaking, we must expose and oppose crimes against humanity.
How supportive was your order as you were making these plans and going into this action?
When I came back from Africa, I asked where I felt I could, you know, work best in this country. And I had been to the nuclear test site in Nevada 20 years before. This is 2003 and 4 now, really mainly 2004. And I realized that they needed somebody in Nevada, so I was allowed to do community work there and help out with that peace movement for the next 6-7 years. But I was then realizing that was nuclear testing, and the action at Kipsack Bangor in the state of Washington had made me see, was 2 years later, that nothing really had happened. So we were ready to make another message. And so I asked to be able to focus just on nuclear weapons for a year. And they were very, very supportive of that. And I didn't have to say what I was doing. We are an order with whose charism or whose mission is to meet the wants of the age. And we have been studying what are the wants of the age since we began, encouraged by our founders, Cornelia Connolly, in 1846. So we've been constantly searching to meet the wants of the age. And I could see that this couldn't be a more important want of the age to meet, to try to meet.
Let's take this into the action itself. At the point that you were dropped off and you were facing that chain link fence as you were about to go in, what were your thoughts? What were your feelings? Were you scared? Was this a profound moment? Did you pray beforehand? How did this get started?
We had like an 8-day retreat before that in the area of Knoxville with the people who were very happy to be part of this designing and shaping of what would happen. And just the wonderful grace of energy in our shared prayer through the 8 days, and we had known from satellite, whatever, I didn't have to worry about that, exactly what and where. And so we were dropped off not in front of the chain link fence, but before the woods, you know. We were able to mount the ridge, which is Oak Ridge, in the dark, and we just followed, and we just walked through, no path or anything. We just headed to the top, winding our way, and obviously we were led, and then we finally, after about 2 hours going up, we reached it, and I wasn't even thinking about being afraid because we were getting through, and nobody was stopping us, and we could look down on this. It was probably 4:30, so before dawn, and we just were able to move right on down. And we were inside the three, well, first the outer fence was still in the woods. That didn't take any time. And we closed it up, you know, with little plastic ties. Very short, right angle, two sides of a triangle. so that we could slip through with a flap. And we were all rather thin people, and it was very easy. And then we got to the top of the ridge and looked over, and then we just kept on going. We saw a bat security car just drove by. We saw it drive back, and then we just started and got to the first of the last three fences. Couldn't have been 5 minutes to get through one. Nothing was electrocuting us. We just moved on and got through three, and we were there by 4:45, and I had looked, last time I looked at my watch, it was 4:45, and we did exactly what we knew we were going to do, totally unheeded, unimpeded, and it took maybe 10 minutes, maybe, you know, you didn't look at your clock, but not long at all, and then we had finished the three or four things we planned to do. Quietly, not having any, just we were all very focused. And then this very, way down at the opposite end of the building, which is very long, this van that had been driving around the roadway before drove right next to the building, probably 25, 30 feet inside the last fence, I guess. I don't really remember. I mean, I couldn't measure exactly. And anyway, it drove very slowly up to us, and we were ready to meet it. And we bowing before them. It was just that one man, Kirk Garland. And we read, he was willing to listen to our, we just were ready to read to him why we were there. And that is available, and I hope people know that. We wrote that during the retreat in the 8 days before.
Given a link to it, I will definitely post it up on the website in connection with this episode so that people can actually read what
said. The two things that we brought in were the statement, and then the second one was the indictment, a list of what laws were being infringed by continuing the manufacture, testing, use, and storage of nuclear weapons.
So it sounds like, rather than what has been reported, that you were there for 2 hours before a guard showed up, that it was really a relatively short period of time.
That was it's always, I find that it's just a mistake. We landed on the downside of the ridge at probably, I think it was by 2 or 2:30. So we were looking at it by 4:30. Okay, so it could be like 2 hours to get up the hill.
But the actual action itself, it sounds like it took maybe 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, certainly 20 at the outset, at the most. Anybody could have done it in that little time.
How did the guard respond when he suddenly came upon the three of you on this site?
Yeah, well, it wasn't all that sudden. It was slow. He responded just by looking at us. We could hear him saying on the phone, his cell phone, they're peace protesters. You better send somebody along, something like that. He had known that we were peace. It was most obvious that we were peace protesters. And he had had that experience. He had been at Rocky Flats for many years and then somewhere else. And, you know, you can always tell when they're peace protesters.
How were you treated by the authorities when they did show up?
I felt that they were, I mean, there was this, the second person was nervous and had his gun and this and that, but it was very gently. We were handcuffed and told to sit on the ground, and which we did. You know, this is now 5:15, 5:30. Took a little while for the more vans to come. And we were on the ground with our hands cuffed at the back, with our ankles cuffed. From then on, you know, we watched the sun come up. People gradually, you know, like undressed, because it was Saturday morning. Those that were higher up in the line of the marshals spoke very politely to us. Do you want to answer some questions? You don't have to without your lawyer, kind of thing. And then we sat there. You know, it wasn't until maybe 10 o'clock they brought three collapsible chairs, but we would stand up, you know, just because it was stiff and all that, and they had to help me get up. You know, you'd stand maybe every 20 minutes for 5 minutes or something like that. It took them all that time to get their act together, in other words.
You were initially charged with misdemeanor trespass, And then suddenly the charges were upped to damaging a defense facility under the Sabotage Act, which carries a sentence of up to 20 years in prison. And there was also the charge of causing more than $1,000 damage to government property, which carries up to 10 years in prison. Why do you think the charges against you were so dramatically increased in their severity?
Obviously, they didn't want a trial. They thought we would try to get out easily with a plea bargain.
Oh, was that the strategy?
Absolutely. They always want plea bargains.
Was there any question in your mind about taking the plea bargain?
No question. No possibility of a question.
And what did you hope to accomplish with the trial and the resulting disability?
To doing what we had to do. It's the obligation of every, we're all equally responsible to expose and oppose known crimes. So there was nothing else we could do but do it in order to make a very clear message quickly.
I know you take your ministry with you wherever you go, and you ended up spending over 2 years in prison. What was it like for you in there, and what sort of work were you able to do or were you moved to do with the women who you met there?
I would say I was more minister to than ministering. With ministry, we believe, is totally shared. It's a giving and a sharing and a receiving, and none of those can be exaggerated in order to be harmoniously accomplished. And it happened to me. I received as much as I shared, as much as I gave. We always say in West Africa, go by opposites when you're in the reality of the thing. Nobody could imagine what the reality is until we experience it. And I have been overawed by amazingly strong and gifted women and some compassionate men. There were not many for me to interact with, but some were very respectful and interacting that way. But, of course, I was fellow inmates. And I also had a lot of time to interact with the world because I did try to respond in some way to everybody who has written, either by a joint letter, because people need to be honored. I mean, everybody is involved in this, and equally, whether they're writing letters, whether they're sitting at home with their arthritis, or whether they're just, you know, sending the energy through prayer to harmonize and heal the world. And it's just part of that grand scheme of healing the planet of its wounds and being healed, of course.
In this time between your release and the fact that you're going to still have to go back to court for resentencing sometime this summer on the one remaining charge, what are your plans for this period of time before you find out finally whether they are going to put you back in jail or whether they're just going to declare time served and let you go?
I haven't had time to do any planning. My time has been taken up and programmed by something ever since we were released last Saturday evening at 6 o'clock. So I just followed what was the next call, for, you know, the next day, what had emerged. I had a remote plan. I knew that I could, you know, get a medical checkup immediately and then some recommendations in the same building to see whatever I needed, slight checkups, which were very, very minor. And everything is very mild, and I don't have anything to worry about. You know, it's just very practical things. So I'm just staying nearby and doing, accomplishing those things and trying to respond to telephone calls from people like you. We haven't even had a chance to talk to each other, Mike and Greg, you know, because Greg was in transit, and there just hasn't been time for me to dial them and nor them to dial me.
Were you in contact at all during the time that you were imprisoned?
Not really, really. We were meant to be, but Greg got his paperwork done coming from Leavenworth, but each of the places where I was just didn't respond to it. We had a right to be in touch with each other, but we couldn't. they never came and told me it's okay to do it.
In your mind, where would you like your action to lead? What do you want to happen now? And given that the listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat are international, we have 38 countries that listen to this show on a monthly basis. What can we do to support you in where you want this to go next?
I don't think that I'm seeking support for me. There's only one thing to do, and that is anybody who is available and free and carrying on with what they're all doing to expose and oppose nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And I see that people have each has their own gifts of creativity, their own style of doing it, and I totally honor, I'm going to say you, and I'm speaking to all the people that you're in network with, and thank you. And just carry on and continue to see how we can make this message, you know, more, you know, and just react to the denial of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference, you know, the review that just ended on Friday. And let's support the ray of hope there, the countries that are just getting out of that thing because they failed. New York Times doesn't even mention what was happening at the UN for the last month. So we all need to get in touch with the people who are involved in these international treaties, and what can we do? How can we speak out? Because we are the majority. We're not the minority.
Sister Megan Rice, you are one of my heroes. I am honored to be speaking with you. I support you, and if there's anything I can do to help you in the future, please do not hesitate to let me know.
You're doing it, dearie. You're on it. So this is a mutually assured admiration society. Should we say that?
Thank you so much for that. Sister Megan Rice, you are a hero to so many of us, and I am deeply honored that we've been able to spend this time together on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Bless you, dearie, and divert to the... to what you're doing. You're doing a great job, and thank you.
Sister Megan Rice.
We'll continue with this week's holiday special Nuclear Hot Seat in just a moment. But first, I want to thank all of you who donate so generously to Nuclear Hot Seat, be it a one-time or occasional donation, or those of you who underwrite the show with monthly recurring donations. By your actions, you show that you value honest, verifiable information on nuclear issues, continuity and context on the stories you care about, news updates, expert interviews, a view at the cutting edge of what's really going on in the nuclear world, as well as tolerance for the attitude and attempts at humor that I make. Now, as the year ends, we're going through a progressively more complex attempt at a website upgrade. Don't ask, but you try migrating more than 400 hours of audio. The fee to accomplish this is going to be far above what was initially budgeted. So please help Nuclear Hot Seat get its new, more searchable, more functional website, because that's where the year-end donations will be targeted, so that we can continue to keep the information flowing out to you. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send us a one-time or continuing donation of any size. And for an easy and expensive way to help out, you can send the show a monthly $5, the equivalent of a cup of coffee and maybe a nice tip to the barista. That's also at nuclearhotseat.com if you click on the big green donate button. Know that whatever you do to help, you are helping to combat the nuclear menace in all its forms with solid, footnoted, reliably sourced information every week. That makes me deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to the continuation of this week's special, Nuclear Hot Seat.
I next spoke with Greg Borcha Obed, another of the three Transform Plowshares activists who took part in the Y-12 action. Greg is an Army veteran who lived at a Catholic worker house in Minnesota, and was 57 years old in 2012 when the action took place. Last Monday, May 18, was his 60th birthday and second day out of prison.
Going back into the action that started everything, when and how did you and Sister Rice and Michael Walney come together, and how did it evolve that you did this Transform Now Plowshare action?
Well, Megan was the initial spur. She had attended the trial for the Disarm Now Plowshares, and she felt very moved by the expert witnesses and the testimony of the defendants, and she felt she should do such a thing. And she ended up calling me, and then we collaborated for a while. We discerned, we prayed, and then we kind of like contacted other people, and Michael was interested. He just heard about it, and he contacted us.
And how did the three of you know each other? Was there prior connection? Were you part of some community together?
Oh, yes. Megan and I lived together in community in Baltimore, maybe for a year. And Michael lived in a nearby community in Washington, D.C. And I've known Michael for 20 years, maybe. And we did a Plowshares action together before this one.
There were certain actions that you decided to take before going there, which included the spraying of the outside of the building with baby bottles of donated blood, spray painting anti-war graffiti, singing, praying, putting up banners. Why were these specific actions chosen, and how were they chosen?
Well, there is a long history of Plowshares actions in the U.S. and some in other countries in which hammers and human blood have been used as symbols. And we felt we wanted to join that tradition of peacemakers, and so we brought small hammers. We didn't hammer on weapon parts like other Plowshares actions. We hammered on the wall. That's a symbol of fulfilling a prophecy in Isaiah that in the latter days, people will learn God's ways and beat their swords into plowshares. And that's where the hammer comes in. So we hammered a little bit on the wall in a symbolic act, and it symbolized our hope of the crumbling of the nuclear weapon infrastructure. And the blood, we poured the blood on the walls as a symbol of what the weapons actually have been doing when we make them, because many people die from just the uranium mining and the producing of the weapons and then the testing of the weapons. Rosalie Bertel estimated that 10 million people have died just from the making of the weapons. And so it was a symbolic act to say we are against this killing, this potential mass murder of the planet, and we're willing to give our blood to prevent more bloodshed.
Within the movement, as I have been coming into and experiencing it, there seems to be a separation in people's thinking between mining and weapons and reactors. Do you agree with this separation or not, and what would your reasons be?
When I was in the prison, I read a book by Robert Gleason, forget the title, but it had to do with nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And he makes the point, and quotes other people, that when you make a nuclear power plant, the waste material from that is fuel for a nuclear weapon. You can alter that, you know, enrich it, not too difficultly, and make a weapon. And so what he says is, if you're against nuclear weapons, you really need to be against nuclear power also. And that when we as a nation promoted nuclear power all around the planet in all these other countries, those are precursors of potential nuclear weapons.
Going back to the actual action that you took, what did you do to prepare for it, and what did it take to get you to the point that you were actually in front of that first chain link fence?
Well, we spent many, many weeks in prayer and discernment and study. We studied that the issues regarding the three nuclear weapons plants that have been proposed by Obama, and then Congress had given the money for them. And so we knew from studying the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that this trend of modernizing our weapons, nuclear weapons, is illegal. From our viewpoint, from the Nuremberg treaties, if you are aware of your government committing a war crime, you have a right and a duty to take steps to intervene in that war crime. And we understood that the building of this next weapon factory, they call it the uranium processing facility, that would be a further war crime. And so we studied, we collaborated, we went on retreats. Megan and I went on a retreat about Gandhi. And so we looked at the spiritual roots of protesting and how if you take on suffering yourself, that is a way to bring about social change. That was a fundamental teaching of Gandhi. And so Plowshares actions are part of that history. And then Michael met up with us, and we continued to pray and study and look at our symbols. We wrote up two statements. One was an indictment of the government war crimes, and one was our group statement communicating the values and our purpose for doing the action.
When you actually began to take the action, were you frightened? Were you exhilarated? Was there any point when you were doing this where you felt like second-guessing yourself?
There is a lot of trepidation and uncertainty when you're preparing to go into an area which we knew was called the lethal force zone. We wanted to go all the way up to the building, and we knew there were these high security fences, but we also knew from our faith and from other Plowshares actions that, surprisingly, the Spirit does lead people to complete and to do the hammering and the pouring of blood. And so we were very hopeful also. Now, during the action, when we approached that inner fences that said lethal force zone, and we knew there was some kind of technology for motion detectors and maybe microwaves, they even said in advance there's other technology that they weren't publicly saying. So when I approached that with Megan and Michael, the thought did come to me, we're not going to make it. This is just too advanced, too difficult, and we should turn around. But then like a split second later, the inner voice said, well, you came this far, you should keep trying. So we cut through that fence. No sensors went off, no alarms were ringing, there was no spotlight, and we just proceeded calmly, and we cut through the next fence, and we were able to do everything we had hoped to be able to do.
How long were you actually at the site before the guard showed up, and what were you doing when he did appear?
Well, it is a big facility, and there's a long ways over the woods and all. So we cut through the first fence, and then it was maybe an hour or more, but there's not sensors by the first fence. There's not even barbed wire. But once we cut through those last three fences, it might have been 10 or 15 minutes when we get through the last fence to when the guard came. And then we had poured the blood. We had spray painted. We had put up this is a crime scene tape, and we had put out the other symbols of the bread and our leaflets and the books that we brought. Michael was still spray painting at the time, but Megan and I had finished all the work that we had done. So it did feel like a very complete action when the guard arrived.
How did the guard respond to you, and did you feel in any way in danger when he did find you?
The first guard was very professional, we felt. He was calm. He was rational. He spoke to us. We spoke to him. He understood we were protesters. We said we were here. We were led by God. We gave him our statement. We read our statement to him. We sang songs. This Little Light of Mine is one that I recall. And he was not a threat. He was not hurtful or harmful to us.
Were there other guards who came to back him up, and did the situation change then?
Yes. The second guard, I believe, was his supervisor, and he was very belligerent, and he gave the order to put on the handcuffs very tight and then refused to loosen them. And that caused a great deal of pain, especially to Michael and I. Michael's wrists were bleeding by the time we were brought to the county jail, and one of my wrists was completely numb, like for months later, because he really abused his authority, I believe.
Now, the three of you were initially charged with misdemeanor trespass and destruction and depredation of government property, all of which are misdemeanors. But then the charges were changed to damaging a defense facility under the Sabotage Act, which carried a sentence of up to 20 years in prison. Why do you think the government made the change in the severity of the charges against you?
Well, technically, I think first we were charged with trespass. That was a misdemeanor. Then we were charged with malicious destruction. That was a 5-year charge. I think that's a felony. Then we were charged with destruction of government property, which is a 10-year felony. And then, you know, after some time, they offered us a plea bargain. They said, plead guilty to the 10-year charge, destruction of government property, and we will not bring further charges. And they said, if you don't plead guilty to the 10-year charge, we will bring 3 or 4 more serious felonies and give you life in prison. And they were talking like Homeland Security charges and the sabotage charge. And our lawyers conveyed this to us, and we said to our lawyers that we are not guilty, the government is committing war crimes, and so we will not plead guilty to any offense. And therefore, they brought the sabotage charge.
How was it going through the trial?
These trials are very difficult because the government introduces motions to prevent your testimony, to prevent our expert witnesses. We had Ramsey Clark testify at a pretrial hearing that what we did was legal, that what the government is doing at that factory is unlawful. They are committing a war crime. And all that testimony that Ramsey gave before the judge was ruled inadmissible. And we were prevented from saying those things during our trial also. It's called a motion in limine. It's really a gag order on the defendants to speak freely about our motivation and what we understand the laws to be. And so it's really very difficult to go through such a trial.
It sounds like the government was afraid of the three of you and what you had to say and reveal in the course of the trial.
That is one way to put it, and the reason is, in previous Plowshares trials, in the U.S. and in other countries, when the defendants can speak about their motivation, and they can speak about the Nuremberg principles, juries have failed to convict. And that is the concern of the government. There's even been trials in other countries where Plowshares activists have been found not guilty several times by juries.
Now that you have been released, and there's going to be a resentencing coming up this summer on the remaining charge, but it is generally believed by your attorneys and by those of us within the movement that you're going to be released with time served for the time you've already been in prison. What are your plans between now and the resentencing, and what are your plans afterwards should you be given your complete freedom?
Well, I think we should back up one more step.
Okay.
Our attorneys have said that the process of appeal is not over with. The government has until June 22nd to appeal the circuit court ruling in our favor. They can ask for a 15-judge panel to reverse it. And some of the attorneys say it's likely that the government will appeal it, but then it's uncertain what the full panel will do. We're hoping that that they would agree with the 2-1 decision. But that's still up in the air. So we're not, like, ready for resentencing yet. It could be quite some time if the government appeals and the circuit court wants to review it again.
Moving forward, is there any plan for the three of you to write a book or have a book written about this or in some other way continue this message, whether you do continue in prison or not?
Maybe you haven't heard, but there are 2 books underway right now by professional writers. One is by Eric Schlosser, who wrote an article for The New Yorker about our action and about Plowshares' action. He is expanding that article and making some corrections and hopes to have it published by August 6th, the last time I heard. He was going to call it Gods of Metal. Maybe that will get delayed because of the appeal, but that was the last word I had from him. And then Dan Zak, the Washington Post reporter, is working on a much longer and much more detailed book about this particular action.
If you would have any lasting impact from this dramatic action, this self-sacrificing action that the three of you have taken, what would that be?
Well, we hope that all around the world, people will begin to stand up and speak out and oppose this modernization of the nuclear weapons and the continued proliferation to other countries, and that this will be a sign for peace activists and, you know, for ordinary people that the forces of violence do not always win. There is a stronger force with nonviolent and with taking nonviolent action, which can break through sometimes, and we hope, like, be a beacon to give encouragement to people.
And if there's anything that the international listenership of Nuclear Hot Seat can do to support you moving forward, what would you ask of us?
All around the world, people can take actions where they are. Many people around the world did write to us and encourage us. But my understanding is with this non-proliferation conference that just occurred, there is a movement to try to, like, have a grassroots swelling against nuclear weapons. And many, like, non-nuclear power states are taking the lead in this. They are saying the nuclear weapon states must disarm. We signed the treaty. Other people signed treaties saying that they wouldn't develop weapons if the nuclear power states disarmed. And so we encourage everyone to be a part of that movement, to speak out, to act out, to say now is the time to stop building the weapons and to get rid of them.
That's the ICAN program, and we have covered that on Nuclear Hot Seat as well. Greg, is there anything left that you would like to say that we haven't had a chance to cover?
Well, I'm just very, like to express great gratitude for all the people who are working against nuclear weapons. Many, you know, thousands of people wrote to us with their support. 16,000, I think, signed a petition or sent cards and letters to the judge. And I'd also like to thank our attorneys for all their great and intense work on our behalf. And thank you for your role in this also of communicating the need for disarmament.
That was Transform Now Plowshares activist Greg Borcha-Obed. The final chapter in this story took place on Tuesday, September 15, 2015. That's when U.S. District Court Judge Amul Thapar placed the activists on 2 years of unsupervised release. During that time, the activists are free to go anywhere they like, as long as it's not onto the grounds of any nuclear facilities, which are prohibited. And there is now the case of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who nonviolently and symbolically disarmed the Trident nuclear missile submarine base at Kings Bay, Georgia, on April 4, 2018, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. They face years in prison for exposing illegal and immoral nuclear weapons that threaten all life on Earth. We hope to have interviews with some of them in the near future on Nuclear Hot Seat. And under this episode, number 444, we will link to their website, KingsBayPlowshares7, that's the number 7, .org, with its appeal for your letters to the sentencing judge. Here's today's final thought. Peace on Earth. Isn't that what we wish for each other at this time of year? That we have peace on Earth? But what exactly does that mean? What and where is the model for peace? Would we know it if we encountered it? Or is peace such an outdated, outlandish, boring concept that we wouldn't recognize it as something good if it smacked us upside the head? After all, the economy of the world, or at least here in the United States, seems to be based on war. Close to $1 trillion was dedicated to the military and the war machine in 2018. We cram men, women, our children, resources, the education and health of our nation, the very fabric of the future itself, into a seemingly never-ending meat grinder of death and destruction that we export to the rest of the world, wreaking havoc from ground and sky. Why do we make such horrific instruments of mass destruction? Because for a small sliver of the population, war is highly profitable. War is big business. And what's bigger in war than nuclear weapons and the threat of them being used? And what's a bigger threat to war and nukes than the outbreak of peace? After all, in the president's cabinet, we used to have a Department of War, which in 1949 was renamed the Department of Defense. But we don't have a Department of Peace. We have never had a Department of Peace. We don't even look at peace as an alternative. It's just, how much more can we throw at endless war? So maybe, like Sister Megan Rice and all the other concerned individuals who make a stand in whatever way they can on behalf of people and the environment, of care and support instead of hate and destruction, we can advance the cause of peace, not only in this holiday season, but beyond. How? Sign a petition. Write a letter to a legislator. Attend a talk or a meeting to learn more. Talk about what you learn to others. No action is too small, no person insignificant. We need you, all of you, because it's not over till it's over, and it's not over yet. This has been a special encore presentation of Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 24, 2019. Voices from Japan co-producer Beverly Finlay Kaneko, the amazing crew of volunteer social media posters led by Tara Johnson Douglas, musicians Marilee Weber and John Barnard, who breathed life into my little ditty to create the music that you hear on the show, and activists around the world who get your information to me in a timely manner, which allows me to then report on it to the rest of the world. And of course you, the listeners. That's why we do it. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that you should not go back to sleep, because even in this holiday season, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.